Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
American history is no stranger to charismatic Christian leaders. From the likes of George Whitefield and Samuel Davies during the nation's colonial period, to renowned evangelists such as Billy Graham, Pat Robertson, and Joel Osteen today, our nation's history is filled with vibrant religious personalities. But perhaps no other American preacher had more glitzy star power and influence than Amy Semple McPherson, one of the most dynamic preachers to grace the nation's religious landscape. Sister Amy, as she was known, may not be a household name to many now, but during the heyday of her ministry in the 1920s and 30s, her life was frequently the center of public attention, and her career frequently intersected with many of the movers and shakers of the day, including Williams Jennings Bryan, Upton Sinclair, Mahatma Gandhi, and Charlie Chaplin. Amy's calling was fundamentalist religion, and she integrated a passion for old-fashioned revivalism with newfangled technology and American patriotism. She championed the cause of prohibition and spoke out against the dangers of teaching evolution in the schools. And her footprint is still seen today, not only in the style of preaching she engaged in, which included the pioneering use of radio and Hollywood theatrics, but she is the founder of the International Church of the Four Square Gospel, a Pentecostal-based denomination that today claims over 8 million members worldwide. Who is Amy McPherson, and how did she get to be such a major figure in America's religious history? To answer these questions, I'm pleased to be joined today with Dr. Matthew Sutton, Associate Professor of History at Washington State University and a graduate of the UC Santa Barbara. Professor Sutton is the author of Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America from Harvard University Press, and is currently conducting research on American evangelicals and the politics of the apocalypse. Matt, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi, Tony. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Matt, you're a historian, and we know that historians, they're all about the chronology of things. So I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curve here, get you off your game a bit, and take things out of temporal order. Instead of starting at the beginning of Amy McPherson's life, where people would normally think biographies would start at, I want to jump right to the America of the 1920s and 30s, and specifically the world of Southern California at this time. Actually, let's stick with the 1920s, because this is when Amy McPherson inserts herself into Los Angeles life, and it's a very interesting life for a Pentecostal, evangelical-style pastor to be inserting herself in, especially given her background. So give us some idea of what is going on in America in the 1920s, and specifically Los Angeles.
Sure, I'd be happy to, and you're absolutely right. Historians are all about chronology, but we also like to mess up the chronology a little bit. So I actually opened my book with Amy rolling into Los Angeles, because I think your question is exactly right. We need to understand the context and the world that Amy enters into before we take a step back and understand her life. But the world that Amy enters in the 1920s is one that's changing fairly dramatically. The United States has just come out of World War One. In politicians, the general public, American leaders are generally calling for a return to normalcy, and that becomes Warren Harding's famous campaign slogan in the 1920 election, is a return to normalcy, to get past all of the kind of chaos and the turmoil and the tumultuousness of the 1910s. And so for many Americans, what that means is a return to a more traditional life, a more traditional religion, more traditional values. But the irony here is that their lives were anything but traditional, that things were changing so rapidly and so quickly that Americans in that period looked very different than they had in earlier generations. And mm-hmm. So for a few examples of that, one was rapid urbanization. For the first time in the 1920s, the majority of Americans, more than 50% of Americans, are living in cities rather than in the countryside. And so that has a dramatic effect on how people live their lives and how they think of space and how they think of their jobs. This is also a period where mass media is taking on new and tremendously important forms. The radio was invented, was actually being used in the early 1920s for the first time, and then just spread like wildfire, so that by the mid-20s, it was common to have a radio in every home in the country, just about every home in the country that was electrified.
And this really creates media stars, too. I mean, this is the you have your Buffalo Bills and your Will Rogers, perhaps, before then, but this is the era that movie stars and radio stars are really created, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And Hollywood is one of the things that comes with radios, and also you have the rise of movie theaters and these movie palaces, and film goes from something you see in these small Nickelodeons to something that became these epic dramatic affairs, these beautiful theaters, these elaborately constructed theaters. And so, yeah, within that you have the rise of a new celebrity culture. And the movie studios are at the foundation of doing this. They realize that they can build loyalty, build fan loyalty, build audiences by talking a lot more about the personal lives of their stars. And so while a couple decades earlier they actually didn't even want to include credits at the end of their films, they didn't want audiences to know who the stars were because they just wanted the loyalty to be to the film and to the studio. By the 1920s, they realized they actually could make more money by building loyalty to particular stars, even if that cost them more. And so Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, Charlie Chaplin became the most famous people in the United States in this period. And readers, viewers, consumers can't get enough of their lives. They love these magazines. They love knowing the latest ins and outs of what's happening with Hollywood stars.
Mm-hmm. What's happening religiously in the country at this moment?
There's also a lot of change in terms of American religion, and this also refers to or relates to the idea of returning to normalcy. That, on the one hand, the mainstream of American Protestantism has evolved pretty dramatically in the previous 20 and 30 years. Darwinian evolution has had a major impact and has helped push scholars and theologians to rethink how literally they should take the early Genesis accounts. You have the rise of literary criticism, which is being applied to the Bible, so people are beginning to wonder, did Moses really write the first five books of the Old Testament?
Mm-hmm.
You have changes in terms of technology, which is facilitating communications, and Americans are becoming more aware of world religions, that there are other faiths out there and that other people believe other things. And so all these things create sort of a crisis within American Protestant Christianity. Some adapt to the crisis, some embrace it, some try to evolve religion along with it to make it more applicable to modern life and modern trends. Others react by calling for a return to the fundamentals, for going back to the basics. And so out of that comes what becomes known as American fundamentalism, which is this commitment to the authority of the scriptures, the necessity of individual salvation, and the idea of going out and making converts, that the most important thing a person can still do is to have a born-again experience, much like it happened for generations and centuries, in fact.
Mm-hmm. And this in Los Angeles, too, specifically, there's some ferment going on, too. The Azusa Street Revival is really starting to see the awakening of what becomes known as the Pentecostal movement. Is that correct?
Exactly, and that'll have a major influence on McPherson as well, that in the late 19th and early 20th century, a group of these fundamentalists, these conservatives who were trying to go back to what the Bible said and only what the Bible said, began to take literally some of Jesus' New Testament statements as well as some of Paul's and the experience of the early church in the book of Acts, which shows that those people who had had a salvation experience, who had been born again, then received a secondary experience called the baptism in the Holy Spirit or the baptism in the Holy Ghost. And so for particular groups of Christians, they began to believe that like had happened in the book of Acts, there would be signs that would follow this baptism in the Holy Spirit or this baptism in the Holy Ghost. And among those signs would be the ability to lay hands on the sick and see them healed, and the ability to speak in new tongues. And so there's some debate about when this revival really begins, but sometime around 1901, people began actually speaking in tongues for the first time in a few generations. And it has happened intermittently throughout church history, but it had been something that hadn't been well known in the early 20th century. So suddenly you have these conservative Christians who are speaking in tongues, who are seemingly healing people, and then they begin to hold revivals to spread this message. And the center for these revivals is Los Angeles in 1906. It's a small storefront church on Azusa Street, which is a very dramatic, very vibrant, very charismatic interracial revival, which really is the first time this new movement, this Pentecostal movement, becomes well known. And so in many ways, it's another form of fundamentalism. It's another move among Christians to return to the basics, to the foundations of Christianity. But it's a much more experiential, much more ecstatic, much more exotic form of Christianity than many Americans are used to at the time.
Yeah, I think we're really setting up well these interesting contrasts, specifically in Los Angeles, the Azusa Street fundamentalist Pentecostal revival that is going on at the time, mixed with shortly thereafter the secular Hollywood culture that just seems to wallow in the excesses of the now and of the material world. And this is the world that Amy McPherson comes into and really makes a splash. So now let's go ahead and rewind the tape and go back to the beginning of her life. Where was she born? What was her upbringing that leads her eventually to Los Angeles?
Sure, and like it would be for everybody, the path was not straight. And she was born in 1890 in Ontario, in Canada, in a kind of middle-class farming community. Her father was much older than her mother. Her father was a Methodist and had been just kind of a devout Methodist all of his life. Her mother had been orphaned and had been raised in the Salvation Army, raised by some leaders of the Salvation Army. And so when the two of them got married and then had a child, had Amy, the influences on Amy drew on from both of those traditions. And so on the one hand, there was her dad's kind of classic Methodist faith with the idea of having a baptism in the Holy Ghost, which had been typical of Methodism, this idea of sanctification. And at the same time, her mother's embrace of the Salvation Army and going with her mom to Salvation Army meetings really influenced her. And the Salvation Army was very innovative at the time. They also used media, they used technology. Mm-hmm. They knew how to draw a crowd. And so that had a major impact on the young Amy. So as a young girl, she embraced the religious world of her parents. She loved it. She spent lots of time in church. She spent lots of time going to Bible meetings, going to revivals. And she also would integrate faith into her childhood games. She would play Salvation Army on the school playground, where she would, you know, create a makeshift drum and a banner and lead the students around the schoolyard in a march, a Salvation Army march. She would hold revival services in her bedroom with her stuffed animals, and she would preach to them. So this was a pretty atypical childhood in a lot of ways. By her teenage years, though, she began to have some doubts. She began to question the Christian faith, as many teenagers do. And then these doubts were exacerbated by her high school geology class. The textbook that she was using in Canada at the time taught that the Earth was tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, and even maybe millions of years old. And so for McPherson, this represented a problem for her, that she wanted to believe, and she had been taught to believe, in the old-fashioned literal truth of the Bible. But here she is in her geology class being taught by another authority, by a teacher, that the Earth was millions of years old. And so she began to ask lots of questions of her parents and of her minister, and she didn't get any satisfactory answers. And so this creates a real crisis of faith, and she really begins to doubt the truth of Christianity and essentially walks away from the faith for a short period of time. And it's shortly after that, though, that the Pentecostals, who we talked about a minute ago, decide to come to town, to her small Canadian town, to hold a revival. And the evangelist who's going to lead this revival is a guy named Robert Semple, and he was an Irish immigrant who was traveling the country, traveling with North America, Canada and the United States, preaching the tenets of Pentecostal faith. And so the idea that these people are engaging in some pretty strange practices spread throughout the community quickly. And so Amy wanted to go and see it. She wanted to experience this revival, not so much because she believed it was the work of God, but more because she was curious. This is a great show, and it's free. What else are you going to do on a cold winter night in Canada?
Exactly. It's early. You know, this is before mass media, so, you know, revivals, tent revivals, really have their draw.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can go see this foreign guy who turns out that he's attractive. He's got an interesting accent. Who's also going to practice these religious experiences, these things, speaking in tongues. So McPherson goes to the revival, and she's immediately captivated both by Robert Semple, the man, and by Robert Semple, the message that he represented. And so that night she reconverts, she dedicates her life to Christianity and to the tenets of the Pentecostal faith, and she falls in love. And so it's shortly after that she and Robert end up getting married. And then that really sets her life on a new trajectory as she moves away from her Canadian, the security and the comfort of her Canadian middle-class home.
Yeah, we do. We typically associate Amy McPherson, for those who are familiar a bit with her history, with Los Angeles, with Hollywood, where she puts her roots down in the 1920s, but she really forges her religious bona fides as a itinerant preacher, much along the lines of George Whitefield during this era. She's traveling all over the place, right?
Yeah, she's traveling with Robert for a couple of years. They spend some time in Chicago, and there's not a lot of documentary evidence or archival evidence left on Chicago. I wish I had been able to find more on those Chicago days, because Chicago in the 1910, 1911, 1912 was a very, very vibrant place, much like Los Angeles in the 1920s. And she was there, she was in the middle of it, but we only have just some faint pieces of evidence about what her life was like. But the most dramatic thing and the most important thing that happens in this period is that she and Robert decide that God has called them to go to China to serve as missionaries, to spread the Pentecostal faith to Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And being Pentecostals, they did everything on faith. They didn't do a lot of planning. They didn't learn the language. They didn't study the culture. They didn't raise much money. They essentially just packed their bags, got on a steamship, and went to China. And it was there that McPherson further learned to depend on herself and to depend on Robert, but to really learn how to depend on herself, because there was no infrastructure, there was no help, there was no support. She was just having to make her way in this foreign country where she didn't know the language and she didn't know the culture. And this became even more of an issue when Robert got sick. They weren't really familiar with dietary practices in China. They didn't know how to properly prepare food. Robert ended up getting dysentery and then also malaria and ended up dying shortly after their arrival in China. But they had been together just long enough for Amy to be pregnant. So Robert ends up dead, leaving his wife stranded on the other side of the globe with child, with almost no money. And so this becomes one of the first major obstacles or first major crises in Amy's life that she's going to have to figure out a way to overcome.
And how does she overcome it?
So the way she does it is essentially, again, by taking a step of faith. She hopes that God will provide. Depending on your personal theology, either coincidentally or you can call it the sovereignty of God, but some money arrived in the mail. And that got her enough to get onto a ship back to San Francisco. And then she was able to make her way back to New York City, where her mother had rejoined the Salvation Army and was working with the Salvation Army. And so she spent a couple years. And in this period, she doesn't talk a lot about it. And again, we only have essentially her accounts of this period, but there's some hints and some evidence, especially in the older autobiographies and the older pamphlets that she wrote, of this being a very dark period in her life, that she was really questioning God once again, really doubting God, really trying to understand how this man that she was sure God had called and chosen to lead this great revival had in fact abandoned her, had left her, that God had taken him from her. But she ends up rebounding, spending a couple years raising her daughter Roberta, working with her mother in the Salvation Army, and there she meets another man, a guy named Harold McPherson, who is a middle-class businessman. And he took a quick interest in Amy and decides to marry this young widow. And so the two of them get married and move to Rhode Island, where Amy settles down for what seems to be a typical middle-class life. And it could well have been, we would never know who she was, that would have been the end of her life.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, there's more obstacles, more changes. She ends up getting very sick, and this is after the birth of a second child. She has a son named Rolf. She ends up getting very sick and then decides that God has called her, that basically he's giving her a deathbed call, that God has told her that either she needs to recommit her life to serving as an evangelist, to serving God, or he's going to take her. She's going to go to heaven. And so she decides she will go. And so she has this dramatic account in her autobiography of God saying, now will you go? Now will you go? Now will you go? And finally she says, yes, I will go.
So she gets called to basically go on the revival trail once again throughout the country. How does this sit with her husband? I mean, her husband was her second husband, Harold McPherson, was an accountant, right?
Right.
And not the kind of, up and go spontaneously kind of guy, I would imagine.
No, exactly. And so this is a challenge for him and for her, and it's a challenge for a historian to look back at the sources and to understand what's really going on. Because for McPherson, she obviously puts all the agency on God, that God has called her, she has no choice. Either she's dead or she becomes an evangelist. For us, we have to wonder how much of that was McPherson's own will, her own volition, and how much of it was, in fact, her sense of what God wanted. So she goes on the road. She actually, when she makes the decision to go, she initially essentially abandons her husband. She packs up the kids one day when he's at work. She leaves a note on the table saying she's, tried to walk his way. It's been a failure. Now won't he walk her way?
Surprise!
yeah. And then so she takes off to her parents' house back in Canada. He follows up with a telegram that tells her to come back, act like other women, to wash the dishes and to do the laundry.
Mm-hmm.
But she, of course, never returns to dishes or laundry again. So once Harold realizes that McPherson is serious, that Amy's going, he decides to join her to try to make things work. And so for the next few years, McPherson crisscrosses the country preaching revival, and he basically stands in the shadows. He follows her along. He does some preaching on his own, but he's not very effective. He's not very successful.
He's an accountant.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't expect revivalism to come from the accountant profession, with all due respect to our accountant listeners out there. So.
Right. Even those baptized in the Holy Ghost might have a challenge.
No, that's true.
But, he could probably collect the tithes, though.
Mm-hmm.
So within a couple of years, he basically fades into the background, and eventually they quietly divorce. And so essentially from the late 1910s, basically the end of World War One, it becomes Amy's show, that she's on the road as a revivalist. The kids are with her at times, and her mother joins her to watch the kids. And so she's traveling all over the country. And it's at that point then that she rolls into Los Angeles and decides that maybe it's time for a break, maybe it's time to pack up the revival tent and to look for something a little more permanent, especially as her kids are getting near school age.
And no better time to settle down than in Los Angeles, which is a fairly nice climate, having lived there myself, and you were just up the road at Santa Barbara. I want to go back. That divorce, it doesn't seem to be a big issue for many, maybe, in today's world, but a divorce back then, especially if you're in a Pentecostal revivalist type of religion, how did that sit with others?
Yeah, it didn't sit well with them. It was one of the most controversial things you could do. In the 1910s and 1920s, Americans were divorcing in increasing numbers. And so for conservative Protestants, this was a major sign of the culture's decline. And so, to be a woman preacher, we should also talk about that, but also even more to be a divorced woman preacher was pretty scandalous.
Right.
And so part of why McPherson ends up on her own is because of the divorce, because she'd initially worked with some Baptists, she'd worked with some Methodists, and she'd worked with another burgeoning Pentecostal group, the Assemblies of God. But none of these groups were real comfortable with her status as a divorcee. And so she essentially decides that she's going to have to strike out on her own to blaze a new trail, because the institutional established Christianity just couldn't, had a hard time stomaching a woman preacher, but hadn't even, essentially an impossible time stomaching a divorced woman preacher.
This is rather interesting from a behavioral perspective, because as a behavioral social scientist, I'm also interested finding out, where do our morals come from? Do our morals determine our behavior? Does it work in reverse? Does our behavior determine our morals? And, from that point, when she has that divorce and is put on her own, that it really does seem to affect some of her thinking. I mean, she is embedded into this conservative Protestant fundamentalist tradition, but not so much for the divorce thing. Let's push that one aside, not
right.
Really harp on that too much.
Right, and that's exactly right. And it's the same thing with just the idea of a woman preacher, that
right.
On the one hand, you have these very traditional gender roles, in that one of the things that the conservative Christians are trying to hold on to in the late 19th and early 20th century are these conservative gender roles. It's the liberals, it's the modernists who are challenging those. And then here's Amy, who's this woman who comes in and she says, I've been called by God to preach, and she says that God has called me essentially to leave my husband to go on the road as a revivalist, not to stay home and raise my kids and take care of him. And so it's a tight rope that she has to walk, a fine line, but she does it fairly skillfully by downplaying the reality of what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I do in my book is I try not to get too theoretical or to get too beholden to methodology, but Judith Butler, this gender theorist, talks about gender performance and the way that people perform their gender, and I really see McPherson doing this, that she, her actions defy everything that we know about proper women's roles in the 1920s, but her language reaffirmed everything we think we know about the period. So she emphasized marriage. She emphasized the importance of marriage. She emphasized the sanctity of marriage. She emphasized women's traditional roles, that women as helpmeets to men, is the idea of being traditional wives. And so in her mind, she was an exception to this, and she could justify it biblically with this idea, and this goes back to her Pentecostal faith, that in the book of Acts, Peter says that, Peter quotes the prophet Joel saying, in the last days, I will pour out my spirit on men and women, on sons and daughters. And so McPherson argues that there's this sort of exception, that in the last days, the Holy Spirit is going to come on women as well as on men. And so that essentially justifies her actions. But this is something that that Pentecostals have often struggled with, which is back to your original question, mm-hmm. the idea of morality and ethics versus kind of theology, and that is that Pentecostals tend to be, because they're more experiential, they tend to be quicker to make exceptions for personal mistakes, personal frailties. And we could say it more positively, they're more graceful. They tend to make more allowances for personal mistakes than other groups of conservative Christians. And so I think McPherson found a lot of support in the Pentecostal community, although it was certainly an issue right. throughout her life and within the subsequent organizations that she built. There was a lot of controversy as to whether or not they would allow anybody other than McPherson to maintain ministerial credentials with a divorce. And in fact, they decided essentially that they would not, that they grandfathered her in, but nobody else could be divorced and be a minister in their group.
Yeah, this is, I was going to hold this off till later, but I think it's a great time to talk about this now. But when you read McPherson's biography, and again, I urge our readers to pick up a copy of your book. We'll link to it on our website. It's a great read. And you really pull out a lot of these contrasts, contradictions, and tensions within her life. And one of the issues we were just talking about when you talked about Judith Butler's work about feminism and stuff, another thing that is going on here in the early part of the 20th century is the women's suffrage movement, and women empowerment beginning at this point in time. And despite the fact that Amy McPherson is preaching a very traditional message, her life that she exhibits to others, particularly to other women, is one of, I can control my life, I can basically build a large business or empire or church here, that that signifies that other people can do this as well.
Exactly. That's one of the things that attracted me to her in the first place, was exploring these contradictions. And she's very human, and that's one of the things I really like about her, that people often ask me whether I like Amy. And I would not have worshipped in her church, but I really like her as a person. I think I would have enjoyed going out and having a beer with her, except she didn't drink officially, although she may have unofficially. But but the gender contradictions are one of the most fascinating things, that she drew fans from the most liberal, the most progressive walks of life, because people saw her as an empowered woman, as somebody who represented the new woman of the 1920s, somebody who was venturing into careers that had traditionally been controlled by men, and who were doing it essentially by themselves. And so both older career women in the 1920s, especially journalists, just loved her, and the young flappers, the kind of young women, the trendy, hot, modern, kind of exciting women of the period, also love McPherson.
Mm-hmm.
And so she really represents these tremendous contradictions, that on the one hand, she's got this legion of followers who are very conservative, who dress very conservatively, who act very conservatively within her religious organization, but then there's these outsiders who just can't get enough of her, who are fascinated by her and who really laud her, both in the press and just in the general public.
Yeah, you can kind of pick up these contradictions, too. You have a number of pictures throughout your book that signify this, including one on the back cover that shows her in the 1920s, roaring 20s kind of dress at that time. And you look at that image, and again, it's a very Hollywood type of image with the architecture and stuff of the time. And you can only look at her and you say, that's a preacher? She doesn't seem to be a preacher. She seems to be one of those dynamic, go-getter women of the time. But on the other hand, you read what she's doing in her church and the message she's preaching. It's really different. It's really interesting.
It is, and this is where, to come back to the historian's craft, is you really have to watch the change over time. Because when she first gets to Los Angeles, she does look more like a traditional preacher. She doesn't wear a lot of makeup. She's, a traditional kind of revivalist, what you would think of as a conservative revivalist. Doesn't wear a lot of makeup, doesn't wear much jewelry. She's kind of frumpy. Her hair is out of style. But by the late 1920s, after a decade in Hollywood, absolutely, she could walk into a room with Mary Pickford or any of the famous starlets of the period and just blend right in. I mean, she looked like them, she acted like them, she talked like them, she dressed like them. She really did become a Hollywood celebrity on par with the most famous people in the country in the period.
Well, talking about that Hollywood celebrity, one of the things she becomes known for in Los Angeles is forming the Angelus Temple and the Foursquare Church. And the interesting thing, perhaps because of the time that she was there and everything else that was going around in Los Angeles at that time, she quickly adopts the technologies of the time, of that era, to create Sunday services that could rightly be called, I guess, religious spectacle, a la Hollywood. So tell us a little bit about what she's doing in her ministry at this time.
Sure. Well, when she decides to settle in Los Angeles, and again, to stop traveling, she decides instead of taking the revival around the country, she's going to bring revival to L.A., and the idea being that there are so many tourists traveling through Los Angeles in the 1920s that they can come into her church, they can experience Pentecostal revival, and then they can take it back with them to wherever they're from. And so her goal was never to set up a permanent church with a permanent membership. She didn't want to do that. What she wanted to do was build a permanent revival tabernacle where people could come to Hollywood, come to L.A., could see her, and then could take her message back with them. And so to do that, she builds this enormous church, Angelus Temple. It's 5,300 seats. It's built much more like a theater than a church. It's got two levels of balconies. There's a huge stage in the front, a giant orchestra pit. It's circular, so you can sort of see the front, the stage from every seat. It looks much more like a posh Hollywood theater than it does a traditional church.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that she draws the crowds, one of the ways she competes with Hollywood is by, as you just mentioned, Tony, embracing technology. And you can see some of the roots of this probably in her upbringing in the Salvation Army, because they did it on a much smaller scale and in a previous period. But their idea of using spectacle to draw a crowd is something that she embraces.
And praise and showmanship and such like that, yeah.
Exactly. And so what she does is she taps into the tricks and the trade and the opportunities that are there in Hollywood. She hires theater people. She has access to, first-class costumes. She has set designers. She has stage men. She has lighting, all of which was as good as anything you would see in a Broadway show or in a Hollywood stage. And so what she does is begins to create and to write what are called dramatic sermons, or she calls them dramatic sermons, every Sunday night. And so the church itself ended up holding, in the early years, about 21 services a week. These were huge, but the most famous services were these Sunday night dramatic sermons. And so they were theatrical shows, and they always ended with a very simple message of the importance of being born again, of having this personal salvation experience. But to get to that message, Amy used all kinds of tricks and tactics. And so one of my favorites is called the Heavenly Aeroplane. And what she did is she often used real-life events to build these sermons, and if she could get some free publicity, she was quick to take it. And so this is one of those situations where she had been invited to fly up to San Francisco for a radio exposition, and this, of course, is in the early days of flying when it's still a fairly novel thing to do. And so she chartered a plane, just an open seat, two-person biplane. There was a lot of press to watch her takeoff in Los Angeles, but it turns out the pilot wasn't very good, and the very rudimentary runway was also not very good. And so the pilot ended up steering the plane into this huge ditch. The plane crashed, shattered the landing gear. Basically, the nose dove into the ground, and the tail came up into the air. And so there were pictures of this spread all over the newspapers in California and really over much of the country. This was a huge story. And there was newsreel of her. She ended up chartering another plane, flying to San Francisco, and landing at the Presidio, and there was great newsreel footage of that.
Which is pretty incredible in itself, because if my airplane does a nose first dive into the ground, I don't think the next thing I would do is get on another plane and say, okay, take me up to San Francisco.
No, exactly. This is pretty typical of her life. I mean, she just had no fear. I mean, mm-hmm. she was willing to try or to do anything, but yeah, that's exactly right. It was a little crazy probably. So because there's so much publicity, she decides to then do this dramatic sermon called The Heavenly Aeroplane. And so what happens is when parishioners walked into the church that Sunday night in 1925, what they saw was a stage that was set up to look like a runway. There was a grassy strip across the stage. There were hills in the background, mountains. And on it sat two miniature planes. And then suspended at the top of the church above the stage was a model Holy City. And, of course, the Holy City was supposed to be heaven, but it was also crafted to mimic or to match the Los Angeles skyline. And mm-hmm. She was very much a booster of Los Angeles, since the idea is that Los Angeles is the holy city. When McPherson came out onto the stage to preach her message, she was wearing a leather flight uniform, a jacket, goggles, a leather hat, kind of a skull cap. And so then she preached her sermon. And what she did was she explained that the first plane on the stage had the devil for a pilot, its engine was sin, the propeller was temptation, and self-righteousness and disobedience were the wings. Then a voice called out, "Right this way, step up, ladies and gentlemen, all aboard for the theater, for dance halls, for card parties, for riches, and for popularity." and then McPherson would yelled contact. And the plane essentially taxied across the runway and then crashed into a small explosion. And she was very good at using these kinds of dramatic effects to really capture and captivate the crowd. Then she turned to the other plane. This one, she said, was piloted by Jesus, and it would shuttle all who accepted Christ as Savior to the Holy City. The engine on this one was the Holy Spirit, the propeller was faith, and the wings were obedience and love. And then once again, she did, you know, 3, 2, 1, contact. This plane taxied across the runway and then took off. McPherson had used cleverly concealed wires to actually lift the plane up, so it flew over the audience a couple times, circled, and then went up to the heavenly city. And so then McPherson ended with a traditional altar call, the idea that everybody should get on the heavenly aeroplane.
Mm-hmm.
But it was these kinds of stunts, these kinds of sermons that made her an absolute draw in Los Angeles. And so the Chamber of Commerce was boosting her. When tourists would come to L.A. and were asked what to see, they were told, go see Amy, go see her, give one of these sermons. There was standing room only every Sunday night in Angelus Temple. And certainly one of my favorite sources was I came across a diary in Kentucky in a small archive at, I believe it was the University of Kentucky, of a 12-year-old who had come to Los Angeles and kept a diary of his travels. And he talked about the two most important things that he wanted to do and got to do was to see Douglas Fairbanks in a Hollywood movie and to see Amy Semple McPherson on her stage.
Wow.
And that's really what she had come to symbolize and come to mean in 1920s Los Angeles.
It's interesting. The life that she leads is incredible, filled with this drama, you know, some of her own making, some of that she stumbles across. But there's another event that comes in later that punctuates her life. And I want to hold that off for a minute and just sidetrack here a little bit and talk about how McPherson interjects herself not only in the life of Hollywood drama, so to speak, but in the political life of the world. Your book does a really nice job of laying this out, and there's a number of issue areas that she becomes very much integrated in. Some of these in the early 1920s, some of these become more important later in the 1930s. Give us a sense of some of these. One of them was the creation versus evolution debate, and where does she play a role in this in the United States?
Sure. Yeah, she was very interested in politics, not in a necessarily partisan sense, but she believed that the United States was a Christian nation, and that it was wavering from its foundations, and that she wanted to do what she could to try to restore it to its Christian foundations. And so that meant a lot of different things in a lot of different areas. One was it meant supporting prohibition and supporting the efforts to reduce alcohol consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was exactly what you just mentioned, which is the creation controversy, that in the 1920s, this is, of course, the heyday of evolutionary controversy within the public schools, although I guess I don't know if it's appropriately to call it a heyday since it's still with us. But what was happening was more and more schools were adopting Darwinian evolution in their curriculum, especially in biology and then also in geology classes. And so fundamentalist Christians, conservative Christians, began to mount an attack against this. And that was, of course, led by William Jennings Bryan, most famous in the Scopes trial in 1925 when he went down to Cleveland, or not to Cleveland, Tennessee, but to Dayton, Tennessee, to try to help the people of Dayton determine that they should be able to teach what they wanted to teach in their schools. And what the majority voted for, what the majority wanted, was to not teach evolution, to teach the traditional literal creation story. And so McPherson got very involved in this battle. She supported William Jennings Bryan. He had spoken at Angelus Temple numerous times. She held a parade in Los Angeles during the Scopes trial in support of him. And then she also worked in California to try to get ballot measures passed to mimic the ones that had been passed in Tennessee to outlaw the teaching of evolution in the public schools. And she also worked to try to get Bibles put into the public schools, that some states were beginning to reduce or eliminate Bible reading from their public curriculum, public education curriculum, and McPherson wanted to return the Bible to the public schools. And so she was involved in those issues in the 1920s. And then in the 1930s, she got involved in other campaigns. In the context of the Great Depression, there were lots of fears that communists were gaining power and gaining influence in the United States.
Well, let me back you up. You mentioned prohibition.
Sure.
What was her relationship with prohibition? And from your book, a very interesting, strange bedfellow stories occurs here with prohibition and who she allies with in trying to basically eliminate the evil liquor.
Sure. Yeah. She'd been involved in prohibition campaigns in the 1910s, but then in the late 20s, prohibition is beginning to falter. It's becoming clear that prohibition is spawning a whole new industry of speakeasies, of gangsters, of bootlegging. And so a lot of Americans are increasingly wondering if prohibition is a failure, if it should be overturned. And so McPherson gets involved in this, and again, building on both her own penchant for publicity and celebrity as well as that of Hollywood, a number of Hollywood leaders decide to put together a debate, to have a debate on prohibition between McPherson and Walter Huston, of course, one of the most famous actors of the 1920s and 1930s and really on much later than that. And to moderate the debate, they bring in Upton Sinclair, the famous novelist who is most well-known for the book The Jungle, but had continued to write many, many books. And Upton Sinclair was a teetotaler.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't drink alcohol, and he believed prohibition was a good thing. And so they staged this famous debate at Los Angeles' Shrine Auditorium, one of the most famous theaters, and they videotaped it. And it was this huge spectacle, and it was, I suspect, a lot of fun to be there to see McPherson and Walter Huston sort of facing off over the liquor question with Upton Sinclair standing between them.
Yeah, and Upton Sinclair later crosses paths with McPherson again. So as I mentioned, kind of strange bedfellows. So McPherson, both prohibitionist, and Upton Sinclair as well. But later on, the two clash, and this also is an indication of where she inserts herself into the politics of the day. So what happens there with Upton Sinclair?
Right, Sinclair was very much a dedicated socialist, and he had been for a long time, and certainly the novel The Jungle conveys that. But in the 1930s, in the context of the Great Depression, and he'd run for office a few times as a socialist and never had any success, so he decides to try something new. And he changes his party affiliation to Democrats, and he jumps into the California primary for governor in 1934. And to the surprise of just about everybody, including the Democratic Party leaders, including the president, Franklin Roosevelt, Sinclair actually wins the primary. And so he then launches a campaign to become governor of California. His platform is called EPIC, End Poverty in California, and he claims that he's going to do this. And essentially he's going to adopt socialist measures, but he's going to do it through the auspices of the Democratic Party. And so this becomes one of the most famous, and probably the most famous, gubernatorial campaign in American history. It draws the media, it draws national coverage. There are stories in all the major newspapers and magazines. The film industry is actually very anti-Sinclair because he had talked about taking over the studios and making them state-run organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So the studios are very anti-Sinclair, and so they're making propaganda films against him, which they're showing right and left. And so this becomes this huge event. But one of the things that Sinclair's opponents realized they could tag him with, that they could use to undermine his campaign, was his seeming lack of faith, his lack of religiosity. That he was a fairly famous skeptic, and some of his books, some of his novels had very critical views, or had represented very critical views of Christianity. And so that got America's, and especially California's, ministers riled up, and many of them began to oppose Sinclair. And so once again, McPherson comes to the forefront. She's concerned about Sinclair. She's concerned about his socialist ideas, which she affiliates or associates with communism, as many people did at that time. And she's also very concerned about his perceived atheism. And so she helps organize and lead a major sermon, a series of sermons against Sinclair right up to the election day, and it was culminated with a famous event, again, at the Shrine Auditorium in 1934, on the Sunday before the election, in which she preaches a sermon against Sinclair, calling on Californians to denounce this communist and this atheist threat and to return America to its pure Christian foundations.
Mm-hmm. And McPherson gets involved in a number of other campaigns, too. What are some of the other political activities she got involved in?
Well, she tends to support Roosevelt, which was fairly unique among conservative Christians at this
yeah.
period. Many were very cynical of and critical of Roosevelt, but she very much liked Roosevelt. She had
previously supported Hoover, though, right?
She did, yeah. She supported Hoover in 28. She's fairly quiet in 32 when Hoover runs for re-election and loses. And then she immediately seems to embrace Roosevelt. But I think the most important thing she does, in my mind, this is another thing that attracted me to this project, is she had a real burden, a real compassion for the poor. And so she built one of the most extensive, probably the most extensive, private social welfare agency in Los Angeles. And she began it in the late 20s, before the Depression hit, which was good, because then she had the institutional foundations ready to go once Americans and Californians and Angelenos especially really needed her. And it was very progressive. She reached out to people of all races and all classes. She was famous for really helping out the Mexican community, which had been scapegoated during the Depression and was really demonized by many Angelenos and seen as a competition, seen as a threat. And so she really served the city in many ways, in ways that, that people still remember today. That is probably her most important legacy to Los Angeles, was the role she played in the Great Depression of really feeding people and clothing people and helping people find, get basic dental and medical care.
Again, an interesting contrast, because Upton Sinclair's platform for running for governor was to end poverty in California, as you had mentioned, the EPIC platform. But she takes it on herself early on, as you say, before the Great Depression, sees this as a role that churches can play, the social charity that had long been part of the history of Christianity in that regard. So I find that interesting.
Yeah.
Let me now, with the time we have remaining, examine perhaps one of the most interesting events in her life. Again, it's a life filled with lots of spectacle, filmed or presented in front of the mass media at the time. But in 1926, something really interesting happens that in many ways, I think, in reading your book, punctuates her life, that there's a prior to 1926 life and then after 1926 life. And it's one of these very odd Hollywood-type stories that, you know, I don't know if it's been made into a movie yet, but it would seem to be a great movie. But that was her kidnapping. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah, this is definitely the event that defines her life in many ways, especially for those outside of her organization. And what happened was, in the mid-20s, the ministry was booming. She was doing really, really well, but she was also pretty tired. I mean, this was a lot of work for her to undertake. So, and a May day in 1926, she goes down to the beach with the secretary for some rest and relaxation. She goes for a swim. Secretary is engaged in a book on the beach. When the secretary finally looks up, she realizes that Amy has vanished, that McPherson is gone. So she gets help immediately. There's a search done. They can't find McPherson. This becomes a huge publicity event. I mean, the newspapers are all covering this. It becomes the biggest story in Los Angeles and really the biggest story in the nation for a few days, what has happened to Amy McPherson. And the church initially believed that she was drowned, that she had died, but almost immediately rumors began to float in some of the newspapers that she had been kidnapped. And so there's these sort of competing narratives. Did Amy die, but there's no body, or was she kidnapped? And kidnapping was not as outrageous as it sounds today, because in the 1920s there were these fears of what was called white slavery, this idea that white women would be taken down to Mexico and sold as prostitutes. And so there were these real fears that this is what could have happened to Amy. So there's controversy, there's media, there's attention, there's story after story after story. Upton Sinclair once again enters into the picture. He writes a beautiful sympathetic poem which runs in the New Republic called An Evangelist Drowns. The Angeles Temple holds a memorial service for McPherson, and after about a month, it looks like the story is gone. Well, just after that, a few days later, so about 35, 36 days after McPherson has initially disappeared, she stumbles into a small town on the Texas-Mexican border, or I'm sorry, the Arizona-Mexican border called Agua Prieta, goes up to the house of some local Mexicans, asks for help, and then passes out on their doorway. They call a cab. The cab takes her back over the border to Douglas, Arizona, and takes her to the hospital. And it's there that she tells her story to the reporters who first arrive. And she tells that, in fact, she had been kidnapped, that she'd been taken by three kidnappers off the beach that day. They'd asked her to come up to her car. They said they had a sick child. Would she come up and pray for it? When she gets up to the car, they apparently chloroformed her, which knocked her out, threw her into the back seat, and then took her down to Mexico, where they were holding her for a ransom. And there had been some ransom notes that arrived at Angeles Temple during this period, but they weren't taken very seriously. Nobody really believed that she was actually being held captive and that she was there for a ransom. So initially, everybody rejoices. It seems like a good story. McPherson has come back. Angelinos are happy. But before long, enterprising reporters discover that about the same time McPherson was gone, her radio engineer, her former radio engineer, had also disappeared, a guy named Ken Ormison. And there were rumors then that Ormison and McPherson had developed a close relationship, maybe a little bit too close, and then the fact that he had vanished about the same time she vanished was too much of a coincidence for some of these reporters. And so they began to pursue this story, to follow every lead they could. And they found bits of evidence that indicated that maybe McPherson had been with Ormison up in Carmel, in this beautiful beach town in Northern California. And so they then got the district attorney involved, And there's a lot of debate as to why the district attorney would get involved, because who really cares? If she had an affair, she didn't have an affair, why is that the district attorney's business? But what I believe and what I argue is that by this time McPherson had gone from the darling of Los Angeles, somebody who had really helped boost the city, to somebody who was becoming a bit of an embarrassment in the context of the Scopes trial, of her politics, of her anti-evolution crusade. But she was seen as sort of a backwater fuddy-duddy, as somebody who was going to hurt the image of Los Angeles and what it was trying to represent, and so they wanted to silence her. And so there ends up being this series of trials to try to determine whether or not she had been kidnapped, whether or not she had committed a hoax, whether or not she had engaged in actions injurious to public morals. And so essentially it became this witch hunt to try to determine what they could about McPherson.
What was the evidence settled on? Was she kidnapped or not? Is there agreement among historians about this now?
There's no agreement. And I, in the book, I'm kind of wishy-washy. I basically say I think she probably had an affair with Ormondson. The circumstantial evidence all points that way. But the Los Angeles reporters, the district attorney, I mean, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that McPherson had an affair, and they never could. So I don't know that it's appropriate for me to sort of stand in judgment over her when the people who were there at the time couldn't quite prove it. But I certainly think that the evidence suggests that she most likely had an affair with Ormondson, and that's the most likely scenario.
You do a nice job of that in your book, just letting the evidence speak for yourself. And I had to ask that question because I was unsure what you did. And as we'll talk about in a few minutes here, you give Amy McPherson a very fair treatment for the complex individual that she is. But again, coming back to this kidnapping, whether it actually happened or whether it was a hoax, and especially the way it plays out in these trials and in the media, and the power brokers of Los Angeles are starting to become a little bit suspicious and wary of her. This would seem to be one of those career killers, one of those Britney Spears shaves her head and runs down the streets in Hollywood type of things that say, okay, you've had your 15 minutes of fame, let's move on now. But what happens to McPherson after all this? I mean, from your book, she basically keeps chugging along, and
she does.
It's another amazing story.
Yeah, and it definitely hurts her career. Especially outsiders become much more skeptical of her. She's no longer the celebrated hero of Los Angeles or of the religious community. But for insiders, they maintain their faith in her, and all the way to this day. I mean, the Foursquare leadership believes she was kidnapped, and so they don't doubt her story. And part of it may be the Pentecostal, again, as we talked about earlier, the idea of divorce. The Pentecostals are just forgiving people.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, some of it, I think, is maybe a little bit of naivete, that they just want to believe the best and believe that somebody who, in their minds, God had used so powerfully could not be so flawed. And I take the opposite view. The reason I like McPherson is because she is human, because she does make the same kinds of mistakes that everybody else does. But that's not the position many of her followers took at the time, or many of the people who follow the movement today take. But the way she rebounds is essentially she does have some loss of following immediately in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the fact that the Great Depression hits, and that she did such a good job of getting involved in Los Angeles, of serving the community, of sort of stepping off stage, of moving out of the spotlight, of spending less time worrying about being a Hollywood star and more time just serving the poor and serving her parishioners, that really allows her to rebound. But she does go through this dark period for a few years after the kidnapping. And then it's around 1936, it's almost a decade later, that she really rededicates herself to the Pentecostal faith that she had experienced as a teenager. And it's from that period through the end of her life in 1944, through World War II, that her life really represents not a Hollywood celebrity, but a much more traditional, much more solid, much more stable Pentecostal leader, somebody who's able to really build a movement that as you said, has 8 million followers today.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that period, because, again, we at the beginning of our podcast here, we talked about the Roaring Twenties and how things were rapidly changing. But then, you know, in 1929, the stock market bubble bursts and things changed dramatically in the 1930s, a depression followed by another depression. Things are very difficult throughout the country. And then looming war ahead, how does she respond to all of this? What path does she take in terms of her insertion, again, into the political debate or perhaps the culture wars of the time?
Sure. Well, she continues doing what she had done in the 1920s, which is to call the nation back to repentance. Mm-hmm. And for her, like many other conservative Christians in the 1930s, they believed the Depression was not caused solely for economic purposes or economic reasons, but that it was also a reflection of God's judgment, that the United States had sinned, that the American people had moved away from God, and that it was important to return to their Christian foundations. And so that becomes a major theme. And so we see her integrating and weaving patriotism with fundamentalist Christianity throughout her career in the 30s and then into the 1940s. And then the war itself becomes this opportunity for her to really rally behind the flag, and so she becomes a great advocate of servicemen. Her church sends Bibles to soldiers. They do everything they can to support the U.S. Armed Forces. And so they really, what we see really happening in the 1940s is this marriage of patriotism and conservative Christianity. And that was fairly unique for Pentecostals. They had spent World War I as pacifists and very critical as outsiders. They saw themselves as aliens and strangers in this land. But by World War II, McPherson and most other Pentecostals had become very comfortable with their American citizenship and with the fact that their country, they believe, represented something special, something that God was doing to really save this world, to bring it into the fascism and totalitarianism that had engulfed Europe.
Yeah, and that again, that those chapters are interesting. You see a much more sedate, I think, McPherson in this era, much more sober McPherson as well. But we see at the end of her life maybe some indications that she was still leading a very tumultuous life. Tell us about how she died and how this might have reflected upon her life history.
Sure, yeah, and she was leading a tumultuous life, although she seemed by the 40s to finally be happy again, which is kind of the irony of where we're going with how she died. But one of the things that she had been doing for many, many years is after she would preach sermons, she would basically get herself so up, the kind of charisma, the energy, the adrenaline of doing these kinds of sermons, that she would have a hard time coming down, and she would have a hard time sleeping. And like many overachiever kinds of people, this was just a constant struggle for her.
Mm-hmm.
So she began taking sedatives, barbiturates, to help her sleep at night, and these were not prescribed, so it's not real clear where she got them. So essentially they were illegal drugs, but they were fairly common at the time. And one of the effects of these drugs is that you could take them, and then they would essentially have an effect on your mind where you would forget that you had taken them. And so what happens in 1944 is she's in Oakland, California for a revival. After the meetings, she goes back to her hotel room. She takes some of these drugs, then she takes some more, and then she apparently takes some more. And she ends up overdosing, and so she ends up dying. And so initially, one of the journalists who first got this story reported it as a suicide. And so ever since, that has been the story that has stuck, is the idea that Amy McPherson killed herself at 54 years of age in Oakland, California. The coroner did an investigation, however, and they found no evidence of a suicide. McPherson didn't seem to be depressed at the time. This seemed to be more typical of what would happen if you took these drugs and didn't really know what you were doing, if you weren't being careful. It was very similar, very reminiscent of Keith Ledger's death a few years back. It was a similar scenario, similar kind of drug. So McPherson may have killed herself, but it's unlikely. The evidence doesn't strike me as very likely that she killed herself, and this was a period where things were actually going fairly well for her, so it doesn't seem to fit. But certainly that also has tarnished her legacy, that if we have a divorced woman who also possibly had an affair, who also possibly committed suicide, she's not exactly a role model for what most conservative Christians aspire to.
And talking about legacy, you finish off your book with some reflections upon this contradictory character who's filled with a lot of contrast in her entire life. What's your assessment of her legacy? How have other people looked at her, and what's your final takeaway after doing this project for a number of years?
Well, one of the funnest things for me was to look at the media legacy, which is that she's read many lives in film and in novels. So you mentioned earlier whether or not there was a film. There's not been a major film made on the kidnapping, but there have been films that have been inspired by her, starting with Frank Capra's film The Miracle Woman, starring Barbara Stanwyck in the early 30s, to then the remake of the novel Elmer Gantry, McPherson becomes one of the major inspirations for Sinclair Lewis's character, Sister Sharon Faulkner, mm-hmm. in Elmer Gantry, which came out in 1927 but was made into a film in the early 1960s, which won a number of Academy Awards. She's also shown up in Pete Seeger's song in the early 60s called Amy McPherson. And then there have been a couple of recent novels that have talked about, that have had McPherson characters. And then most recently, and in some ways I think this is maybe a reflection of the impact that my book has had in the PBS documentary, which was based on the book, but there have been a lot of mentions of McPherson in comparison to Sarah Palin. They're both these entrepreneurial pioneering women. They're both Pentecostals. They're both from rural communities, and so there are a lot of parallels there. But those tend to be the more critical legacies of McPherson. And the insider legacy is the institution she built, the organization she built, the Foursquare Church, which, again, has 8 million people. It's got hundreds of thousands of followers in the United States and many millions in Latin America and in Africa.
And her son was basically running that up till about a decade ago or so?
Right, yeah. He took over after she died, and he ran it into the early 1990s, and he just passed away a couple of years ago. So it's now, you know, part of the National Association of Evangelicals. It's a mainstream Pentecostal denomination. Jack Hayford was the most recent president, who is a very influential writer and speaker. So it certainly has a powerful legacy, and it has left a major imprint in American Christianity. But it has lost some of the charisma of Amy and the spectacle. Like many movements that begin with charismatic leaders, they become institutionalized, and then they move into the mainstream, which in many ways is good, but in some ways you sort of miss, or at least I miss, the barnstorming days of Amy's early years.
Yeah, we've had a recent podcast with Margaret Paloma, who talks about the charisma in movements and how over time it becomes institutionalized. We'll link to that on our website, as well as your PBS documentary. But what's your final takeaway? How do you view Amy McPherson here?
My takeaway is what I said earlier, that I think she was one of the most important, most influential religious leaders in American history. But I also find her a very empathetic character for students, for followers, for scholars, because she was human. And so for me, that's the most important thing, the thing I try to convey in this book, that she both led an extraordinary life, but she had the same ordinary human wants, desires, needs, and passions as all the rest of us. And so she was not a superhuman in any sense.
You communicate that very well in your book, and as I was reading through it, I was always reminded of... Well, she was accused of hypocrisy quite a bit, and I was reminded of an acquaintance of mine who, whenever faced with these church scandals and things, would always say, you know, the church is a hospital for sinners, not a mausoleum of saints. And I think Amy's life, maybe not necessarily being one lived in sin, I guess that would depend upon your view of sin and such, but... It's a tumultuous life in the world of religion, but many ways very human and tells us a lot about our own selves as we read through this.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's the story I try to convey, so I'm glad it came through to you.
Well, Matt, we are out of time, and I want to thank you for being here. I know you're working on another project about evangelicals and the apocalypse, and we're going to have to bring you back in the future here when you develop some more of that research and find out what you're working on. So, Matt, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks so much, Tony. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.